Oedipus Rex by Sophocles. Before we do anything else, let's clear up the pronunciation of O-E-D-I-P-U-S. No literary name is more commonly mispronounced than this one. Americans in particular seem to reverse the first two letters, making O-E sound like E-O in leopard and jeopardy, an E sound. The correct pronunciation is a long E, as in Phoenix, Fetus, and Phoebe. The ancient Greek state of Boeotia is pronounced Boeotia. The god of wine is Enus, and Oedipus is pronounced Oedipus. The name means something like swollen foot or swollen leg. In the play, it refers to an old wound Oedipus bears. In history, it might have a more surprising meaning, which we'll talk about after we talk about the play itself. We'll also look further into the riddle of the Sphinx. The philosopher Aristotle wrote some notes about the drama for his lectures on theater and poetry. He called Oedipus Rex a perfect tragedy, meeting all the elements he considered necessary to elicit from the audience a true catharsis. That means a kind of cleansing of the soul, an uplifted feeling one may experience when seeing what happens when a great soul undertakes a daunting task and sees it through to the end. Yet when Oedipus Rex was first performed as part of a trilogy, a series of three plays presented in competition, the judges gave it second prize, not first. Literary scholars would really like to read the plays that beat it out. But few others would argue with Aristotle. From earliest times, Oedipus Rex has been regarded as one of the greatest tragedies ever written. The plot is engrossing, artfully developed. The characters are fully drawn and believable, and the problem at its center, is Oedipus guilty or not, has given us something to debate ever since. Let's go through the play, scene by scene. There is a prologue, which sets the scene and states the problem, five scenes, and an exodus, or ending. Between each scene, a chorus speaks lines, commenting on the action they have just witnessed, or voicing their inner thoughts. The drama begins with the people of Thebes entering, led by a priest. The city is suffering famine and plague, and all are desperate to discover its cause. In Greek thought, there was no dividing line between natural and moral law. If the gods were punishing the city, there must be some reason for it. Someone must be guilty of some offense. Oedipus enters and asks why they have come to see him. The priest answers, telling of the great travail they have endured. They've come to see Oedipus as the one man most likely to be able to solve the problem. After all, he solved the riddle of the Sphinx and freed them from its oppression, for which they made him their king. Surely now he can help them once more. Oedipus tells them he has anticipated their visit and has already sent his brother-in-law, Creon, to Delphi, to seek the oracle's advice. Creon returns as they are talking and delivers the oracle's message. The former king Laios was murdered. The plague will not be lifted until that murderer is discovered and punished. Oedipus questions Creon, learning that Laios was killed while on a pilgrimage. One of his servants escaped and said that the king and his attendants were set upon by a band of highwaymen. Oedipus promises to find and punish the guilty party. After the stage empties, the chorus makes its entrance for the parados, the first of six choral interludes. They describe the city's suffering and implore the gods to send them deliverance. Oedipus re-enters, answering the chorus, assuring them that he will solve the problem. he issues several decrees. If anyone knows anything about the crime, he is to report it to the king. No one in the city may offer the guilty party shelter or aid. He further prays that the gods will consume the murderer in wretchedness. Oedipus says he is taking the murdered king's part, as if he were his own son, since Laios left no children. He reminds them that he not only occupies Laios' throne, but that he has married the former king's wife and sired four children with her. The leader of the chorus, the choragos, suggests that he might consult the blind prophet Tiresias, who has lived in Thebes since Laios' time. Once again, Oedipus has anticipated the suggestion and has summoned Tiresias, who then enters, led by a boy. Oedipus questions Tiresias, who refuses to answer. Their exchange grows heated, and Tiresias blurts out that Oedipus himself is the guilty man. Well, Oedipus, knowing that he is innocent, becomes enraged and shouts that Tiresias must be part of a conspiracy against the former king and now against him. Further, he suggests that Creon must be in on the plot, since he urged Oedipus to listen to Tiresias. Tiresias prepares to leave and departs with these words: "The damned man, the murderer of Laios, that man is in Thebes. To your mind he is foreign-born, but it will soon be shown that he is a Theban, a blind man who has his eyes now, a penniless man who is rich now, and he will go tapping the strange earth with his staff. To the children with whom he lives now, he will be brother and father, the very same. To her who bore him, son and husband, the very same, who came to his father's bed, wet with his father's blood." For the chorus is appalled by what it has heard. It can't make sense of the wild words from both king and prophet. But its faith in Oedipus is unshaken. He is the man who saved them from the Sphinx. Creon enters, having heard that he has been accused of being complicit in the murder of Laios and is plotting to overthrow the king. He questions the chorus. Did Oedipus really say such things? Then Oedipus enters and repeats his accusations. Creon defends himself, arguing that he has no possible motive for wanting to depose Oedipus. At this point, Jocasta, Oedipus' wife and Creon's sister, enters to try to calm the two men down. Creon leaves, and Choragos asks the queen to take the king inside as well. Instead, she asks him why he is so angry, and he tells her that Tiresias has accused him of being the murderer. To allay his fears and to prove that prophets are not to be believed, she tells him of a prophecy sent to Laios after their only son was born, that his doom would be at the hands of his own son, his son, born of his flesh and of mine. Now, you remember the story. Laios was killed by marauding strangers where three highways meet. But his child had not been 3 days in this world before the king had pierced the baby's ankles and left him to die on a lonely mountainside. The mention of a place where three highways meet disturbs Oedipus. He asks Jocasta for further details and begins to believe that Tiresias may be right after all. He tells Jocasta of his past, that he is the son of King Polybos and Queen Merope of Corinth. One day a drunken man told him that he was not his father's son. His parents angrily denied the story, but Oedipus went to Delphi to be reassured. The god dismissed my question without reply. He spoke of other things. Some were clear, full of wretchedness, dreadful, unbearable, as that I should lie with my own mother, breed children from whom all men would turn their eyes, and that I should be my father's murderer. At this Oedipus fled, vowing never to return to Corinth. As he traveled, he came to a place where three highways converged. An old man in a chariot came toward him, accompanied by retainers. One of them tried to force Oedipus off the road. Oedipus hit the man, and the charioteer struck at him with his goad. Furious, Oedipus attacked and killed all of them. If the man Oedipus slew that day proved to be Laios, then Oedipus himself is the man whom he cursed, the cause of the plague, and must be driven from Thebes. Yet he cannot go back to Corinth for fear of fulfilling the oracle. His last remaining chance is to talk to the shepherd who was with Laios when he was killed. If he maintains that the crime was committed by a group of highwaymen, then the man Oedipus killed was not Laios. Iocasta says she will send for the man at once, and they enter the palace. The chorus is shaken by what it has heard. It is also distressed by the manner in which Iocasta dismisses the pronouncements of the oracle. They remind themselves to be reverent in the ways of right, and call on Zeus to witness that reverence for the gods has died away. Iocasta returns with offerings for Apollo, to whom she prays for deliverance. As she prays, a messenger enters, inquiring where he might find the king. Directed to Iocasta, he tells her that he is from Corinth, with news of the death of King Polybos and an invitation to Oedipus to return and take the throne. Iocasta joyfully sends for Oedipus. She tells him that he can now be freed of the fear of murdering his father. But Oedipus still worries that he may somehow marry his mother. The messenger tells him that his fears are groundless, because he is not Polybos' son. Polybos and Merope had him as a gift from his hands. Years ago, the messenger was a shepherd on the slopes of Mount Kithaeron. He was given a baby boy, its ankles pierced and bound, by a shepherd from Thebes. Caragos tells Oedipus that the Theban shepherd is the very man sent for by Iocasta. At this point, Iocasta sees clearly the terrible truth, and begs Oedipus to go no further in his inquiries. But he will not be deterred. He wants to know, once and for all, who he really is. He jokes that his wife's agitation is due to the fear that he might prove to be the child of a commoner. Iocasta rushes into the palace. The chorus speculates on Mount Kithaeron and Oedipus' birth. The Theban shepherd is brought in and forced to tell what he knows, that Oedipus is the son of Laios and Iocasta, and that he was given the baby to be abandoned on Mount Kithaeron, but in pity gave the child to the man from Corinth. Now Oedipus has learned the full story of his birth and his crimes. He runs into the palace. The chorus in sorrow mulls the terrible history of the man who saved them from the Sphinx, but who now has been brought low by fate. A second messenger enters from the palace to tell the chorus what he has witnessed. It's a convention of Greek tragedy that scenes of violence occur off stage and are described by a tragic messenger. He tells how Oedipus ranged through the palace, calling upon the gods, how he found his wife mother dead, a suicide by hanging. He takes the brooches from her gown and stabs them into his eyes, so that he might never again see his family or the scene of his crimes. The palace door opens, and Oedipus enters, blood streaming from his empty eye sockets. In a dialogue with Caragos, he laments his fate. Creon, who has now assumed leadership of Thebes, comes in and tries to get him to move out of public sight. Oedipus asks to be driven into the exile he deserves, but requests a final favor, that he be allowed to see his daughters one last time. Creon brings in Antigone and Ismene, who take a tearful farewell of their father. He laments their fate, knowing that nothing but disgrace and agony await them. His children are taken away, and he is led into exile. Caragos closes the play. Men of Thebes, look upon Oedipus. This is the king who solved the famous riddle, and towered up most powerful of men. No mortal eyes but looked on him with envy. Yet in the end, ruin swept over him. Let every man in mankind's frailty consider his last day, and let none presume on his good fortune until he find life at his death a memory without pain. There are probably more questions in the text of Oedipus Rex than in any other Greek tragedy. All of them serve the resolution of two main questions: who killed King Laios, and later, who is Oedipus? Everyone attending the first performance of the play knew the story. What interested that audience was how the plot unfolded, how Oedipus used his formidable intellect to bring about his own ruin. It was not the plot alone which transfixed them, but also Sophocles' magnificent poetry, which is largely lost to us in translation. The tragedy tells us of a deep thinker whose intelligence meant little when pitted against the will of the gods. It is a disturbing story. The gods foretell that this particular person will commit the greatest crimes, patricide and incest. He spends his whole life trying to avoid this fate, only to find that his efforts meant nothing. It reminds us, in a way, of the inscription at Delphi, "Know thyself." In other words, remember that you're merely human, not divine. Or, to put it in modern parlance, your arms are too short to wrestle with God. It was Oedipus' cleverness that gained him authority in Thebes. He answered the riddle of the Sphinx, and in doing so delivered the town from its annual tribute of human sacrifices to the half-woman, half-lion. She stopped all travelers and asked the same question: what goes upon four legs in the morning, two legs at noon, and three legs in the evening? Those unable to answer were killed and devoured. Oedipus gave the correct answer: man, who crawls on all fours in the morning of his life, walks erect in the noon of manhood, and totters on a cane in the twilight of his existence. Defeated, the Sphinx threw herself off a cliff and was destroyed. The Thebans welcomed their savior, making him king in place of the recently murdered Laios, and gave Oedipus Laios' queen, Jocasta. This play is a prime example of just how profoundly Sophocles changed the nature of Greek tragedy. In the earlier plays of the great tragedian Aeschylus, there's a kind of formality about the two principal actors who changed masks to play different parts. They often don't interact in a natural way. Sophocles not only added a third actor, making a variety of interactions between them possible, he also created roles for recognizable human beings. His is a theater of character. This emphasis on character changed theater forever. Prior to Sophocles, the divine background of the story was most important. The plays taught ethical and moral lessons. With Sophocles' plays, attention shifts to the human foreground, where it remains to this day. The divine aspect of Sophocles' tragedies remains, after all, theater arose in religious ritual, but his audience became emotionally involved in the fate of human beings they knew and understood. It is possible to spend a lifetime on various aspects of Oedipus Rex. It is a harrowing tale of human will struggling against forces it cannot control or even understand. It gives us a lot to think and talk about. The overarching question remains, was Oedipus guilty? Dissecting this question can lead to a variety of interesting topics. For example, the contrast between modern thinking and the ethics of ancient Greece, free will versus fate, the nature of the divine, and so on. What do you think? A historical footnote. Is Greece's Theban king, Oedipus, swollen foot, linked to Egypt's Theban king, the swollen thigh Akhenaten, the heretic pharaoh who believed in one god? Several people have linked Akhenaten not only to Oedipus, but also tied his radical monotheism to Moses. And finally, you might ask yourself, why, what happens to an imaginary person on stage often moves us more deeply than what happens to real human beings? What is tragedy? How and why does it produce its powerful effect?